Kunstraum, der Podcast vom Kunstraum Niederösterreich.
Hi, welcome to another round in our podcast series im Kunstraum. My name is Friederike Sperling and I work as the Artistic Director at Kunstraum Niederösterreich. Today I'm virtually joined by the artist Laura Gousselin. Hi, Laura.
Hello, Friederike.
Laura works predominantly in the medium of film and sculpture and creates these amazing theatrical settings, scenographies almost, within which film projections seem to be spilling onto the exhibition floor or semi-transparent curtains seem to be turning us into voyeurs, just as well as actors in her stories. And Laura studied art and scenography at Aalto University in Helsinki and at École Nationale Supérieure des Arts Décoratifs in Paris. She's a postgraduate student from Le Frenois, where she studied with film director Chantal Ackermannen till 2007. And she has exhibited internationally at places like Futura in Prague, MoCo in Montpellier, or Slug in Leipzig, among other places. And Laura, while podcast recordings tend to have an eerie level of abstraction to them, we don't see our listeners, let alone get a reaction from them. Today, it's getting even more abstract because we're recording this episode in separate places. I'm in my office in Vienna. And Laura, where exactly are you right now?
I'm in my studio flat. We have a chance to have programs for artists in France still, where they're organizing flats and working studios with specific volumes that enable us to have some additional space in our living spaces in order to work. So that's where I am, in the south of Paris.
Cool. Before we'll get started, Laura, I would like to provide some context for our conversation. Your video piece, Full Play, which we're going to discuss in detail today, is part of our current group show, Bliss, 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 an exhibition that brings together six different artists looking into various coping strategies in the context of the ongoing mode of crisis. And in a way, the body becomes a sort of portal in this show through which artists ask what consequences the ongoing alarmism has on the way we feel, desire, and relate to ourselves and to others. And since your video Full Play has been presented in different ways in the past, perhaps you could begin by describing briefly the main display elements of the work in the show at Kunstraum.
Well, I like the idea that we're all playing with this notion of disruption of disbelief, both inside of the video, inside of the, what we call the diégésis or the storytelling, as well as in means of sonographies or display. So I believe that the further we're going into the idea of displays, of something that refers to stage and theatre, the more we're giving some means that we're actually in a theatre, we're actually inside of a fiction. And I think that the more we're enhancing these features, the better the suspension of disbelief is going on, because we have the living proof that we're actually in something that is staged. So it's a bit paradoxical, but I think that it both helps to sort of disseminate elements of fiction inside of the exhibition space. And also it gives a relative notion of intimacy with the images. And of course of something that deals with voyeurism, which my mind is really at the root of the idea of cinema and moving images. So I think it's a bit of all that, something to enhance this feeling that was sort of like lifting our disbelief that was fiction in a bit of a paradoxical way, and playing with these notions of voyeurism, which is really important because White Cube, I believe, is also key to sort of create new relationships between spectators themselves as well as between spectators and works, I think.
Before diving into the dense conceptual and iconographic layers of your piece, would you mind laying out the lead plot for people who haven't seen your video yet? What's actually happening in Full Play?
Yes, of course. So it's an ongoing series where we meet a recurrent and solitary character that I perform. The character is called Mom. We find her addressing the camera and fishing vote ballot inside of a sewage, an underground sewage, and she's mentioning the recent elections that happened just a few days ago and explaining that we have no idea still who has been elected. And she acts as, not perhaps exactly a sex worker, but she's called on the phone regularly by another character called Byron, which is a woman, and she's a political counselor. And Byron asks Mom to influence the result of the ongoing elections in order to sort of, well, give it the turn that Byron expects. And we don't know on which side Mom lays, but she's evidently using her sex magic powers, which are basically masturbative powers, in order to have an influence on these elections. Although we don't really know if that is all inside of her mind, what her relationship, what ties her to Byron. We believe they also have an intimate relationship or if it has at all an influence on the election. But what we understand is that there's some sort of a push, and there's something that might turn into a fascist push going on at the surface. Mm-hmm. That Mom is here to try to balance things, perhaps, and we believe that she's on the side of something who is basically against fascism. Mm-hmm. Although she has very strong ties to Byron, which is both probably her employer slash lover slash. So this is basically the plot, and we have the story evolves in such a way that we understand that she also deals with this figure, whom I believe she's a metaphor of Cloaca, of Cloacina, which is the goddess of the sewer. So there are different metaphors inside of the video. Mm-hmm.
In a previous conversation, you described the relationship between Mom and Byron as a transactional relationship. Shall we maybe zoom into that for a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. I think there are different signs that their relationship is transactional, a conversation that is held on the phone, and the appearance of a coin, which is a specific coin because this coin is an antique Lucidia, which relates to the temple of Cloacina, the goddess of the sewage in the Roman ages. And the idea is that this is like an appearance that tells us, well, yes, this is Mom in a way is hired by Byron in order to produce her magic, but she's also hired in a way that she has to demonstrate her sex powers, her masturbation over the phone. So there is something that makes her a bit of a sex worker in a way, and that indicates us that both of their relation is transactional and that there's a very close proximity between power, sexuality, and it's a mean of control over each other. Of course, we don't know who is basically mostly empowered by this. Is it Byron with her the task that she's giving to Mom, or is it Mom with her sex powers over both magic and Byron herself that is mostly empowered? So I guess it's a yes. That's perhaps how I should describe it.
Yeah, as a very small addition, I was wondering if we could briefly look into what kind of temporality the piece is embedded in, because I feel that the entire scenery has something post-apocalyptic about it, or like at least dystopian in a way. And also there's a moment where Mom says it's year zero again. Could we maybe look into that for a moment?
I think that the idea of year zero perhaps refers to the fact that often revolutionary times, historically, like for example, the big revolution in France that started in 1789, but later on also, sorry for referring to only French revolutions, but this is what I'm most familiar with, 68 as well, were times where we decided to use a new calendar, basically. It was Thermidor, it was year zero in a way that we started, oh, this is year 01. There's a recurrency of tabula rasa and temporality in revolutionary times that I find quite interesting, in the way that perhaps time is the reference that is the strongest to us. Once we lose the notion of time, we're quite lost, I must say, on the psychical level. And I believe that the temporality sort of navigates between something that is, of course, mythological, because the setting is, because we're referring to the Cloaca Maxima, which was the first sewage that has ever been created in Roman times. And that is, of course, some kind of a symbol, perhaps, of civilization, because this is the one place underground where water... water are separated, which means that this is a means of sanitization that will provide some health on the level of a group of people. So it means that states, the constructions of power, are in a way taking care of the sanitization of its people. So this is something that evoked me, in a way, the beginning of some form of civilization. Then, of course, there's the idea of digital intimacy with cell phones. And this is basically how, during most of the video, the characters Byron and Mom are communicating. So, but there's also this sort of like recurrency of scenes, and we don't know exactly in which order they occur. So I think this gives this sense of both disembodiment and loss that refers on the, how would I say this, on an effective level to both personally and globally to a sense of strong dystopia and an imminent catastrophe going on. Mm-hmm. And also there's one element inside the video, which is a documentary element. I didn't wish to show big groups of people or demonstrations. I didn't wish to film that, but I decided to use one specific sound, which is a documentary sound of some protests that we had back in France in 2018 during the Yellow Vest. And I thought that'd be very interesting to sort of figure give a context of what was going on politically on the outside, which is described inside the video as a moment of apocalypse and riots and of, well, possibly a turnover in politics where fascist forces, which it's a bit of a capital moment in a way. Mm-hmm. That was also one of the main influences, I guess, in terms of fiction. The fear of this this event happening somewhere in Europe as well.
Maybe we could focus on Mom, the character of Mom in Full Play, for a moment. How would you describe her? What was important for you when building this character?
It is, in a way, it has the character of Mom has a gender identity that is rooted in mine. I wanted it, although, to give signs of a possible transformation. Divorce, for example, is, for me, beyond gender identity, since divorce is a bit deeper. And I find something very interesting in the idea of voice, that identity is so much embedded in voice. That, for example, when a person has wounds such as burns, it is an even deeper attack inside of his identity if the voice is wounded. So I believe that more than skin, voice is a very strong constituent part of our identity and in agency and so on. So I believe that the character was based on the ability, its power of transformation, and the fact that it's not... I also rooted it in some idea of female objection, the idea of a female monstrosity. So it's rooted in different aspects that we can find in genre cinema, in the industry of genre cinema, for example. The character could be both associated to a girl or to a vampire, or to a psychopath. So it has different layers. It's basically the idea also that there's like perhaps many souls inside of the same character. So, and since it was until now mostly the only character inside of the video, Mom would be constantly talking to herself, but in the edit we would play with the idea that there's two different characters talking to each other. So this is how basically the structure, the temporality also was constructed. The idea that, as we say in French, there's a champ contre champ, and the champ contre champ would always be on the same character, but she would demonstrate different elements of different affects and different responses.
Mom is, as you said, a recurring character in your practice. And could you perhaps tell us a little bit about how this version of Mom in full play relates to previous appearances of hers in works like Dead Fingers Talk or Yes, so the Youth Enhancement System series?
I think it's the idea that the technologies that Mom uses in the first two series, which are Yes and Dead Fingers Talk, relate basically to eternity technologies, which makes hers, of course, because it relates to sort of like a misusage of post-humanist technologies, which basically things to make us that prolong our youth. In the first series, she uses bangs made of mummy juice, and that relates to a post that circulated back in 2018-2019 that sort of like tossed the idea that we could use the juice from a mummy that had been recently unearthed to create energy drinks. So I did always like to play with the idea that sort of eternity techniques did have a flirt with gothic stories and gothic literature, vampirism, for example. So basically, in the two first series, Mom uses these techniques, such as smoking bangs of mummy and onanism for sex magic, in order to both accomplish eternity or rejuvenate herself or reproduce herself. But of course, it's a misusage. So what happens is basically the contrary. So she ages, she falls down the social ladder, and here's where we find her. And in a way, I like that the evolution of the character goes from something which is very light, the idea of rejuvenation, as the character evolves, she gets somehow caught into these political maneuvers. I think it's the idea that there's also, as we said first, maybe this proximity between sexuality and power. And in the end, we end up being somehow involved in something that is political, and that there is always a political underside too.
Yeah, maybe we can focus on that for a little bit and also tie this back to Bliss, Bliss, Bliss. So the relationship between sexuality and power within full play. So also the fact that female self-pleasure is in and of itself a sort of non-reproductive act, if you will. And the sort of fact that, Mom becomes a sort of goddess like figure that has superpowers. And maybe could you elaborate a little bit on your choice of or your interest in masturbation in relation to, yeah, politics, in relation to power?
I believe I was at first quite interested in this idea of sex magic, meaning that the power of sexuality was a power like solar power, something that would basically not make a correlation with sexuality or genitality. So I like the idea of viewing this power, even though related to sex, as something which could be decontextualized from genitality and would be something of pure pleasure, of pure energy, such as solar power, basically. But of course, this sex magic belonged to an area of magic that was mainly practiced by men, and it would be questions of heterosexual sexuality. So I wanted it to sort of like cut this relationship both with heterosexuality, both with also male sexuality, and focus on something that's, it's not that it's beyond gender. I wish it were, but it's not. But it's something that is, in a way, it breaks this tradition of, I like the idea that there's, of course, a feminist angle, and there's something that is empowering for women as well. The idea that it's something that beyond perhaps genitality, it means that the body, our body, becomes a surface of pleasure production and of empowerment. And I think this is most important to create that sort of agency where sexuality also is a place where trauma can dwell very deeply. And so I was trying to think of techniques and practices that could completely sort of, well, not make it disappear, but sort of like be as far as possible from this idea of where the trauma is dwelling and where the domination is dwelling. And so that's the idea that I came upon. And of course, I think that sexuality also, and perhaps masturbation, is more on the side of care, of some sort of agency, of something that can hardly hurt anyone. I think it's globally, on a side that's non-predatory, that's non-authoritarian. So
I would like to look at the Roman goddess Cloacina again and the role of filth within the character of Mum, within the video itself in more general, because at a certain point Mum says the open sewage was our living energy, our newborn language and our providential laundry. There's a treasure buried in the ground. It's not gold, it's filth. It is our survival. Can you elaborate a little bit on this?
I think it's the idea really of the soil I think it relates to the idea of the soil as the ground, agriculture, the idea that that we tend to, there are different mythologies basically saying that the soil is dirt and shit. That the soil is filth, and that we want to elevate from this filth. It's the idea, perhaps, of architecture and power, that the circles of power will dwell higher and higher and higher, and tend to be inside of the sky and the clouds, and that the further we go from the soil, the best we are. But then again, the soil is also where things grow. It's also in a way where treasures are hidden, although the actual treasure is the soil itself. So I think it's I don't know if I could describe it differently. I believe it's a sort of like soily metaphor. In a previous video that Fingers Talk, I was also focusing on some elements of text by William Burroughs, which is a soft machine. And I think there's also this metaphor of the soil as a generative matrix where all life grows from. And there's a description of sort of pre-proto-human creatures, proto-human animals, living in the soil, communicating in the soil, eating from the soil. And I find this metaphor quite interesting also because at some point in the video it said when we came out of the soil, we had names. So I think that the soil is sort of like a generative matrix, which is mostly that of a female matrix or non-gendered matrix, but something that separates us from perhaps the paternal genes. So I believe that there's the idea behind that it sort of like cuts the heritage, the name of the father, and I very much like this idea. Yes, I think this is the sewage. I think it's interesting because it's both a space, an architectural space, that also shows us that all the there's a lot of labor happening in there. It was a huge construction, for example, for England to, the United Kingdom back then, to construct the sewage of London. If it were to be done today again, I believe that the UK would not have the means economically to produce it again. And be in order for us, citizens of places, of cities who dwell at the surface, we hardly realize how much labor it takes and how much people who work in these facilities are invisible. So I think it's also, it has to do perhaps also with that as well.
I was wondering if you could share some of your thoughts behind constructing the video itself, as I feel that there are some or a number of different layers to it, layers of reality, if you will, like peepholes that offer us glimpses of different versions of what might be real, almost like a Pandora box. and not only the whole scenery appears otherworldly, but eventually Mom also awakes from a dream so that we seem to have been fooled in a way, especially when instances like these are conflated with moments in which Mom talks directly to us. I think also in towards the end, Mom does so. Could you talk a little bit on your choice to construct the video in this way?
I think it's also perhaps my choice to use video and moving images. I think that moving images are really a good means to provide sort of like other worlds, as you mentioned them, different not versions of reality, because we're always dealing with subjectivity. But I think I like the idea that in the edit, instead of using the rules of what we call fictions, mainstream fictions, authoritarian fictions, we never have a decisive hint. We have hints, but we can pretty much choose or accept the doubt that we don't know exactly what is going on. Is this all happening in the mind of Mom? Is there some degree of reality at some point in her exchanges with Byron? Is there a strong degree of reality in the dystopian environment? Is it our actual environment with a degree of paranoia, or could it be a possible future of our environment? It is already in a bit our environment in my point of view, but I think I like this idea that it's a matter of choice and a matter of perceiving the reality, and that the reality is itself quite complex, and that there is a degree of otherworldliness inside of our reality if we sort of like scratch the surface. And I think that the means of moving images, the edit, the idea that everything is performed, that there's this disruption of disbelief, but also there's a degree of reality inside the performance that is not provided either by space or sound, but it's really embedded in what we try to translate inside of our performances that provides this sort of like context of being able to doubt and to put everything in question. I think it offers like the possibility of a nice sort of critical perspective, this sort of like technology of moving images, because I believe it's really a powerful technology that that can take us, that can both confront us to what we perceive and of our environment, what we project in it. And I find it a bit, in a way, close to science fiction literature, in a way that it's, there's it's a very popular form. We still consume a lot of moving images on different levels. So there's a common language, but that is so common in a way that it has this strange plasticity that has a bit of a less, perhaps, domineering heritage than other forms of art.
In extension of this, I was wondering if we could stand still again at the role of magic, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of the theoretical underpinnings that were sort of informing your interest and your incorporation and your engagement with magic.
Well, we in another conversation, of course, we mentioned Starhawk, we mentioned Susan Greenwood. Susan Greenwood was a ethnographist, but I think I appreciate very much her position explaining that sort of to have an access to the otherworldly, because this is a term that, I don't know if she coined it, but I think it's an important term inside her research and writings. There must be sort of, we have to abolish basically the boundaries between what is studied and who is studying it, of the researched and researchers. So I like this idea of researching it from the inside, but also of being in this difficult position of researching an area where she needs to be researched as well. And I think that her practice came from researching basically magical societies that were based in London in the 80s and mostly 90s, where there was a strong community of both magicians, of people who had this inheritance of high magic, which is basically the magic, well, what is left of the magic that was practiced during Renaissance. And of course, all these practices would be linked to some degree to New Age. But there's a humongous variety of practices. And of course, that was the milieu she was researching during a wide period. And I think that what I retain from the idea of magic, basically, it's also a place to be kept somehow protected. It's sort of like a coat, like the coat of the knight, under which we people who are basically communities of either, I don't know, queer people, for example, where we can be protected and find agency that will protect us from, well, conflicts and authorities and, our surroundings. And it's a place for us to, I think, to find new ways of living and dying together. And I think there's a very strong social parameter in it. And also, I think it's something that is not to be, for example, put against science. I don't think there's science against magic. I think this notion of other world is quite blurry, but I think there is a means of reconciling some practices of science and magic. And we know absolutely now anyway that on some level of observation, when it refers to quantums or whatsoever, they're phenomena that, well, go far beyond rationality. I think the enemy is definitely not science. If it is, at some point, it's not even rationality, but it's this this sort of tendency to oppose the both of them. And I think that magic or otherworldliness is also a territory for minorities, communities, to find some sort of healing.
I think what is really striking about your video, Full Play, but also about your practice in more general, is its flirtation with the horror genre. as well as its ramifications on how it traverses so many of your amazing sculptural works as well, in the form of the abject too. And I was wondering, could you lay out a little bit where this interest stems from for you, but also what you think the horror genre adds on a sort of conceptual level, or why we need these elements right now?
I think I'm very much interested in the idea of horror as being a genre which creates both fascination and attraction. And I think it puts us both spectators or practitioners in an area where there is some, I wouldn't say sincerity, but there is a degree of tangibility inside of this experience of being compelled to something that is horrifying or disgusting to watch or to envision. And I think that there's often a proximity of horror and humor. And I think that they both enlighten each other in an odd way. Of course, there are very different types of horror. We're not talking in the horror genre. The horror industrial genre film is a place of metaphors quite often. It's not a place of documentary horror. But I think there's something quite cathartic inside of this horror genre that also deals with, there's a dialectic with horror and trauma that I find quite important in my practice, my work, and my experience. I think it's also an area in industrial cinema where it wasn't meant to be this way, but there's something that feminist theoreticians could use afterwards, some sort of figures that were constructed quite early after war that could be transformed into, I believe, yes, very empowering and interesting figures. We have, of course, the gal, well, not to say about the witch, but the witch has been a figure that's been so widely used and abused recently that perhaps we should talk about it in another conversation. But other figures, the female psychopath, the primary mom, or the vampire, the lesbian vampire, for example, the idea, all these elements, for example, the menstrual blood, that were like deeply taboo in cinema at some point, were represented in ways that could would be sort of like a videotape, you know, that could enable all different layers of society to consider, okay, well, this is menstrual blood, so what are we doing out of it? And to sort of de-dramatic, I mean, it's still very taboo in some areas of society and communities and so on, but I think that it gave us sort of a ladder to, and tools that could enable us to think of, where does this come from? Why is this considered this way? I think it helps somehow things to evolve in a soft way, perhaps, even though it's still considered B film. I find it quite important. And it's not only horror as an art form, it's also the idea of horror is, I think, everywhere inside of our lives, of course, especially during adolescence. I think that there's a lot of, our traumas originate in many, many different things, be it, war, colonialism, gendered violence, work, hyper-capitalism, politics, but also I think that there's something that horror deals with that's very strong, which is transformation. And I'm interested in also this relationship between adolescence and horror.
And I find it amazing how you sort of manifest this transformational moment within the character of Mom, because in a way she might resemble the sort of archetypical monster figure from the horror genre, but then Mom becomes something divine, something that has power over what is actually necessary to sort of keep the democratic social order in place. And I find it really fascinating how then this monster figure becomes something so beautiful and so empowering through her very special magical skills.
Yeah, I think I like the idea that the goddesses and all these godly entities are not, well, entities to be messed with, basically. They're not, I think it's a conception that's that is quite recurrent in a few mythologies, that they're not equal to us human creatures, that there is something, and I think it's something about power that I like to stress, the idea that power is not necessarily something to be handled by human creatures.
Laura, I think this is a super moment to end with. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation and for giving us so much food for thought. Thank you.